Welcome back to In Focus with David Coletto. I'm David Coletto. On this episode of In Focus, I'm joined by pollster and strategist Don Guy. Don has been working in the world of politics and public affairs research for over two decades, having served as campaign director, advisor, and pollster for the BC and Ontario Liberal parties. He was the chief of staff to former Ontario Premier Dalton McGuinty. Currently, he is owner and chief strategy officer at Polaris Strategic Insights, a vice president at American polling firm Greenberg Quinlan Rosner, and a founding partner at KTG Public Affairs Partners. Don is one of Canada's most experienced campaign managers, strategists, and public affairs professionals, and shares insights into the role of research on political campaigns and how it has evolved over time. Hope you enjoy this conversation. Don Guy, thanks so much for joining our conversation today. How are you doing?
Great, David. Thanks. How's everything in Ottawa?
Things are good. We're recording this right at near the year end, and we're I think all rushing to shut things down in more ways than one, maybe. But end of the year, looking forward to a better 2021.
Yeah.
So yeah. Thanks for joining us. You are a legend, not everyone will say that, but I say that in terms of your experience and sort of the things you've done and seen in what is still, you know, I would say only half a career. You've got lots of runway left. And as somebody who studied public opinion for some time, I'm always curious to ask folks, what's their kind of guiding light to how they view why and how people, come to the opinions that they have and how those might ultimately translate into political behavior. Any thoughts on sort of your philosophy around political public opinion?
Yeah, well, I'd love to actually have an exchange of ideas on this, and I would love to hear yours. I think that, let's put it this way, the view that I left my undergrad degree with, which was constructed so that I could work in public opinion research, prior to there being a program like yours in the 80s. But the view that I left school with is very different from the view I have now. And I think this is what keeps it fresh, because the nature of the influences on how people perceive issues, how they receive information, and how they behave is constantly changing. I mean, you know, we're going to get into this a little later, I think, but it's just a completely different world from the one that I grew up in and trained for. So, you know, at the end of the day, though, people are people. Human behavior is, at its root, somewhat immutable. Mm-hmm. And whether it is because of evolutionary biological perspectives and developments that I think drive a lot of how we behave. Instinct in the way that we receive current situations against a calibration of instincts that evolved over many years. Family and friends, relationships, your duty to protect those relationships and do the best for the people that you care about. There's life cycle issues or life cycle effects, as you well know. We start to feel differently about many questions once we start acquiring property, in particular a home, once we start a family, once we start building investments that need to be protected, and obviously marketing. You know, none of the way that we are wired as human beings anticipated the deluge of marketing messages that we receive. And I think our brains are still evolving in that respect.
Yeah. And I think, you know, to your point about it changing, when I was in school, you know, it felt like there was more certainty on, well, this is how people come to their views and this is how it converts. And that's the nature, I think, of academia, is always trying to find that theory. But I do think that my starting point is, like, people are fundamentally unpredictable, right? They all have a starting point. I think you described that, whether it's your socialization, whether it's your biology, we all have a base starting point. But in this current world, so many more factors can influence how I might move one way or the other. And then that's, I just see it more and more. I mean, in a way, you could argue that it's not always good to compare us in Canada to the United States, but you could, in one way, argue it's pretty easy to predict how somebody's going to behave politically in the United States. But on the other hand, it feels like it's even harder to do that. That you would have never predicted a Trump kind of candidate. People in the UK would have never predicted Brexit. But it's that way in which I think those issues and the way we get information these days and how isolated we can become makes it far more difficult for us to predict how a normal pattern should roll out. And that's sort of how I started things. It's like, don't assume anything is my mantra. And that's why I think we do what we do. We love to understand where people's context is. And that then builds the platform to understand how to get them to do what you'd like them to do.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I was at I think a week or 10 days before Brexit, I was invited to a briefing by the no side. And so I snapped that up as you would. And it was just this sort of relentless PowerPoint deck of all the reasons why it was rational that they were going to win, right? People are going to act in their rational interest because of this economic cost and this economic cost, this economic, like all the reasons that we've heard and that are actually true. And at the end of it, I, being me, put my hand up and said, "Do you have any polling?" And the gentleman, who was really quite a distinguished former government official, said, "No, we don't have any polling. We don't find that we need it because we've been finding in the last few elections that the betting sites are a reliable predictor of election outcomes. And so we're using those." And so we had a bit of an exchange because I said, "So wait a minute, you're betting the future of the United Kingdom on what punters, who first and foremost have enough disposable income that they're willing to throw it away for entertainment. You're betting the future of the United Kingdom on that." And he had a slide of how it was tracking on Betfair. And I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry, I don't think so." And, of course, it turned out that it was a critical mistake on their part to be as reliant on those betting sites as they were, for exactly that reason. They were essentially only gathering the opinions of extremely well-off professional men. Through how they were registering their bets on that betting site.
So sounds like a modern
one day, of the really interesting things in our industry right now.
Sounds like a modern day version of that infamous Reader's Digest poll done in the 1950s, right? That I have always used in my research methods class to point to bias methods and bias data, you know, leading to a different outcomes or conclusions. So that's really fascinating. So speaking about campaigns, I mean, you've worked on, and you can maybe list off some of them, but you've worked on, you know, I'm sure, I don't even know the number, but in Canada, federal, provincial, municipal, globally, you've worked on other campaigns. At its fundamental core, what do you think the role of a pollster is on a political campaign?
Well, you know, there are different points of view. on this question. So I can only share you my point of view, which is that the role of the pollster on a campaign is exactly that and only that. So on campaigns where I'm running a campaign, I don't do the polling. If I am consulting on a campaign and say doing the guiding the advertising and the marketing, I don't do the polling. I think there's a, you need that independent voice on your campaign who speaks only to the research, mm-hmm. as opposed to the other stakeholder needs. I think it's been an asset for me in those other roles that I understand polling. I think it's been an asset that I understand what polling costs. So, but also the way it works, and I can push and challenge the pollster to go further, mm-hmm. In terms of analysis or whatever the case may be. But
it must be intimidating being the pollster working under you if you're the campaign director because of that, right? Sometimes pollsters have this power because they have the data. And if you've got a campaign manager who's never written a questionnaire or understands the sampling strategies, that gives you this cloak of, you know, the secret sauce. You can break it all down and challenge them, which I would find if I was your pollster, could be intimidating, but also a really positive impact on the outcome of the election, the research you're getting. But still, that's really interesting.
Well, and yeah, I think you certainly, you don't want somebody who's intimidated. You need somebody who's also strong. And when I say independent, I'm implying that they need to be strong in that respect. So I've been really fortunate, on campaigns that I've worked on. Michael Marzolini's been the pollster, in together with Elizabeth Senna, for example, it was Elizabeth Christie at the time, with Dan Arnold. Mm. I've worked with Dimitri. They're most of the top folks in Canada I've had a chance to work with on campaigns from multiple sides of the aisle. Bob Penner on the NDP side. But it is helpful if you can speak the language, as you might imagine.
So I want to dig a little deeper and sort of unpack, how you use research, why you use it, how it's changing over the course of your career in your mind. I guess starting with either, whether you're the campaign director, a senior advisor, or the pollster, you've just been hired by a party to help it prepare for an upcoming election. What do you want to know about what people are thinking in the electorate?
Well, the way I see the role of the campaign strategist or campaign director, those aren't always the same role, but is how do I triangulate between what my candidate really believes and is passionate about and animates them the most from a values and an issues in a, a direction or a thrust perspective between what, if it's in a party context, what's the historical brand? What does it, how is it seen? What do its partisans and advocates and activists, what points of view do they have on some of those same questions? And then what does our gettable voter universe, how do they feel about it and where do they want to go? And that, again, to me, it's also why I don't believe that there's a playbook for campaigns. Because that all three of those things are constantly evolving. To come back to the earlier conversation that we had, right? In the context of what's happening in issues and the way that they're interacting with various forms of, various channels and platforms. So I don't ever take a playbook from a previous campaign in, because I think you're then fighting the last campaign, which is right. The critical errors that you make
right.
in this exercise. It's the reconstruction of a new model and a new framework every time between those three sets of needs. And that's where the science of polling comes in, where the emotional intelligence of qualitative comes in. And that's where the magic is, if you get it right.
Are you somebody who prefers one method, like quant over qual, or are you qual over quant, or do you see value in both? I've heard different things from, I interviewed as part of this Hamish Marshall, who did no focus groups during the last federal election, leading up to that federal election. And he was, pretty insistent that there was little value in those focus groups. And I've heard others who only like doing focus groups, who love actually moderating them, getting in there and seeing people. Where do you fall on that spectrum?
Well, ideally, it's fairly critical that you have both. The way I tend to approach it, though, is if I've got a given research budget, or if I'm advising a client or a candidate on the appropriate way to manage research, then I tend to invest a lot on the front before, in the prereq, developing the model of the voter universe and what will move them. And then more relatively speaking, closer to the writ and in writ on qual, so that we're calibrating, we're really listening. That we are calibrating our tools and our messages so that they're operating against the imperatives of the model. Because the biggest challenge I find in political communication is we all have an idea in our head of what we think we're saying and what we're trying to say. And it's the same in any kind of communication. We all have an idea in our head of what we think we're saying. But how it is being received is what matters, not what we think we're saying. And so I'm a believer in both in slightly different way. And I think the other thing that we now have is the advanced analytics in terms of large scale data through some of the social media and digital platforms. That's huge in terms of the ability to generate insights. And also, when you're doing a campaign, things like what are candidates hearing at the door? What are your canvassers hearing at the door? How are sign locations going? There's a bunch of these, ground game KPIs, but also qualitative intelligence that comes back that is hugely important in terms of understanding your resonance. And I'd much rather have a 75% right strategy that is resonating 100% than 100% right strategy that is resonating at 25%. And that's where some of them.
Right. It's kind of like it gives you a gut check, even almost it may not show up in the tracking polls that you might be doing, but if some groups start saying, I don't like the way that Mr. McGuinty's kind of talking about this issue, it allows you to sort of think about the way that issue is being framed and adjust pretty quickly, right? If you're doing them on a constant basis. Like I know Dan Arnold told me that during the last federal election, he was doing, focus groups pretty regularly just for that reason, just to hear how people are, responding. And if you think about, if you don't have that infrastructure set up to do it, and then an issue like blackface, let's say, happens, you've got to gear up to get how people are reacting, yet you need that intel pretty quickly to know how people are responding to that fast moving events. So it's really, that's really interesting. I'm curious how you've worked with many different candidates, leaders, MPs, MPPs, how do you manage the candidate? You mentioned the candidate was being, you know, and their views, their passions as being a really important part to anchor with the research that you do of the electorate. How do you manage that candidate's potential wanting to know how are the polls today? And you know, is every candidate different, or do you have a general approach to how you deal with that candidate?
Yeah, that's a great question. By and large, at least, you know, the way that I would say I was trained to do some of these things under John Ray and Gordon Ashworth is the candidates would not spend a lot of time thinking about polling or talking about polling. There isn't a lot productive that can come from that. But there are occasions where it's needed. You know, if you're on track with your strategy and your message, you're not going to need to talk to the candidate about polling very much. They're also going to feel it. You know, they're going to get some of those same qualitative responses. So for example, with Christy and Christy Clark in 2013, where we were, you know, we had to close up, I think it was a 20 point gap in the course of about 35 days. You know, she could tell because she's an exceptional politician. She is an, you know, just hyper acute set of instincts. And so she could tell that she was resonating. And so you want to that's ideal. You want to reinforce that feeling. You don't need to talk about polling in that context. It's reinforcing the resonance that the candidate is in fact picking up. There are times though where you do have that conversation as a campaign manager. Number one, if you need to do a reset, you always have to explain to the candidate that this is not working, and we're going to have to do a reset. And the reasons why. But, you know, I've been fortunate that more often the first time I talk to a candidate about polling in the writ is 4 or 5 days out to say, you know, we are tracking for majority here. And here's where we're going to focus in the last few days, geographically and which constituencies and things like that. And we're going to put this piece of creative up, which we're going to shoot now, et cetera. So it's more around that kind of conversation.
I've only worked on, I've stayed out of partisan polling for almost all my whole career. I haven't really had that experience, which is a big regret and something maybe I'll fix at some point, but I did work on one campaign, a municipal campaign. In Nova Scotia, in Cape Breton. And I didn't even know the candidate. He needed to do some polling. I got to know him pretty well. But he, when we did our first poll, he was, as you described the Christy Clark campaign in 2013, like he was 25 points down, relatively popular, non-offensive incumbent. It was a different, obviously, case because she was the incumbent. But he, on election day, he just lost, right? Like he closed the gap, but just came up short. And in a post conversation, he said to me, you know, David, I was a skeptic of polling. I had my beliefs. I wanted just to do what I thought was right. But it guided my thinking on the bounds by which the public would accept some of the things I wanted to say. Like I knew what my kind of fence was and I tried to stay in there. And I found that so, like that's where I felt like, oh, I made an impact, right? Like in the work that we do every day, whether we're talking about private sector clients, helping them or politics, it's really about making better decisions on these campaigns, right? And when those decisions are made and it leads to the outcome that's successful, it feels pretty good. It's rare. You know, even when we work in the public sector, private sector, sorry, there's not a lot of campaigns in which there's a victory or not, right? Sometimes there are, there's like an outcome, a policy change you want to make or prevent from happening. What has been for you the most, I guess, fulfilling political kind of moment in your career where your work as a pollster or as a researcher, as a strategist, really you felt helped? Again, no one, we don't like taking credit for success, but you really felt that like that was a moment that you learned a lot and that you felt I helped contribute to that outcome.
Boy, that is a great question. I don't know that it would be a political campaign. I'd have to think about that. I started in 92 and we've been really fortunate. Not just so many campaigns, but so many causes. I'm guessing there are probably one or two causes that are really, near and dear to my heart, where the research that we did helped move a cause over the line. So I would need to think about that. But again, every one of these, the experience that you have as a campaign manager or as a pollster, everyone is different. That is part of what keeps it really fresh and interesting, but it's vital, I think, to you being effective in those roles. If the minute it starts feeling stale, or like a chore, you should stop doing it. I haven't done as much of it in the last number of years since haven't run as many campaigns since starting a family, because frankly my kids are more interesting to me than campaigns, I don't do them as much. And I've really got to care about the cause or the candidate in order to do it. So that's a nice situation to be into.
It changes the perspective. Campaigns are tiring and relentless, right? So you've got to give it all, and it takes everything out of you for those. And it's not just 35 days or 45 days. That's the year before. So I want to end by talking about two things. One, just what we do and reflections on polling. Again, the 2020 U.S. election put into spotlight and raised questions about the accuracy of polling. Again, I'm one who doesn't believe it was as bad as the media say it is. But I do think there's still important questions, and we're constantly thinking about the accuracy of what we do. And can we talk to people? Can we talk to everybody? Whether particularly on the survey side, what's your view on that? As you are constantly like I think me not being challenged, but being required to be able to justify the methods we use. What's your view on polling today and where it's going over the next few years?
Yeah, I I'm open to those criticisms, it's an interesting question. I think that the most interesting development in politics in North America in the last 5 years or so was Trump finding and creating, I think it was 2.8 million new Republican voters in the primaries, in the Republican primaries, who stayed with him in the general, and obviously mainly stayed with him mm-hmm. in the most recent general. And that's a tremendous feat of organization, because it is really hard to find somebody middle-aged who has not been a voter and to get them engaged enough that they will change their behaviors. Number one, they'll start to care. And number two, they'll change their behavior to come back the way we started the conversation. Now that was a huge accomplishment. And, you know, the Democrats, I think, took a page from that in this most recent, in the midterms, and then again in this most recent cycle. And that, you know, that gets really interesting, because where you're creating those voters is on the two extremes of the standard distribution curve, not in the middle. Mm-hmm. We can poll pretty reliably in the middle, you know, the middle 66.67% of the standard distribution curve, but where new voters are being created is on the two poles. And that, to me, again, to come back to this question of keeping it fresh and fascinating and interesting, finding ways to engage those people who aren't traditionally voters is really interesting. And that's where we're finding, you know, at our shop, that a lot of the experience that we have talking to niche markets of consumers who are outside of the sort of broad mainstream, that some of those tools and some of those techniques that we have for finding them and talking to them are really paying off in politics.
And just to clarify, when you say those two extremes, the reason that they are hard to survey or to get into any research is also the same reason they were hard to get to vote, because they are more disconnected, less interested in sharing their views. They don't normally engage in this kind of stuff, right? So that's why, if you are on the, you know, if you're you know, on the left and you've got young voters, for example, coming into the system who may never have voted before and or wouldn't have likely, they're probably not answering surveys. And those Trump voters that are, I just picture this kind of 42-year-old white male, drives a pickup truck, but will never pick up his phone and spend 20 minutes talking to your callers or answering a survey online, right? He's just never going to do that. Millions of them showed up over the last 8 years in American politics, or 4 years, right? So that's really good. And that's something that I keep reminding myself, right? That people who answer surveys are less and less normal every single year. And we need to figure out how to adjust for that and make the methods we use work with normal people, but we're also missing the non-normal folks too. And they're becoming more important in the outcomes. So I want to end really fascinating. I want to end with one kind of question. As you look to 2021, again, we recorded this at the end of 2020. There's perhaps going to be a spring federal election. Maybe, I don't think so, a provincial election in Ontario. What is your mind going to be the lasting impact of this pandemic on how Canadians think about issues? And I'm not going to hold you to what you say, because I'm asking you to predict, and that's hard and sometimes impossible, but we've lived through this almost a year now. You've been, you know, monitoring public opinion like I have. What's your sense of where Canadians are and kind of how that's going to affect how they view politics in the next 2-3 years?
Well, David, thank you for that question. I have spent a lot of time thinking about this. And, you know, earlier in the conversation, I said there, you know, my view on how my perspective on polling and politics is much different from when I left school because of the evolution of so many factors. But one thing that has stayed with me, and I can't recall whose study this was, but the notion that the voting decision and set of considerations underlying it, only about 25% of those are retrospective. About 75% are prospective. So it's not typically a register of an opinion about something that happened in the rearview mirror. It is about who can do the best job going forward. And that's why campaigns matter. That's why we see the shifts that we see in the composition of the vote over the course of a campaign, and why a poll at the beginning of a campaign does not predict in any way the potential outcome of the campaign, particularly in a parliamentary system like we have in Canada. So we see these massive swings. The reason we see these massive swings is because of how voters interact with the set of considerations in the campaign about who will be the best going forward. So I still think that's the case. And that whatever the next campaign is, it will, I don't see why that would change things. It, you know, looking at past elections in the Western world that have followed major disruptive events, it does seem that that pattern has still be the case, still been the case. So that's the way I tend to approach these questions. And
interesting. So at the end of the day, it's really not what did you do for me, it's what are you going to do for me that remains important. So even if you performed well during this pandemic, I'm still going to be thinking mostly about, you know, what you and your party are going to do if you get government again or are brought in if you're the opposition party.
Well, and frankly, you might have screwed up. I might go in as a voter, I might go into the election thinking that the government has screwed up and it's time for a change. But then I get to see what's on offer.
Yeah.
And then I make a decision based on what's on offer going forward. And in most cases, that proves to be the most compelling thing.
Well, I'm not sure I'm excited about a potential spring election, but we'll take it if it comes. Don, this has been really, really interesting. Again, I think you've got so many, I hope you write a book one day, by the way, that sort of details all of this, because I think it needs to be in the record. But until then, thanks for sharing your time, and look forward to it, and all the best in the new year.
I really enjoyed it. Really enjoyed finally getting a chance to spend some time with you after all these years, and you know, just really excited by all the work that you're doing, David. And thanks for this opportunity, and happy to do it anytime.